From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the winter of 1969. A young man had gone to Woodstock that past summer, and now he was thinking about what he'd do for the rest of his life. He fell in love with photography and decided that would be his profession. But before he dove into it completely, he decided he needed to see more of America. And so Mark Brady talked to his best friend. They decided they would embark upon the kind of journey that next summer that so many young people were doing around 1970, crossing the country on a beat-up old microbus, riding it until it fell apart, then depending on hitchhiking, open doors, and the kindness of strangers. Now, along the way, Mark had his camera, and he took photographs, hundreds of black and white images, sometimes haunting, sometimes hilarious. He saw the austere Texas quiet. He saw hippies in Berkeley playing music and reading poetry. Even hung out in L.A. with a young man who had dreams of becoming a star. His name was Michael McKean. You know him from Laverne and Shirley and the Christopher Guest films. But those images, those slides, stayed in a box for about 40 years. A few years ago, Mark decided it was time to do something with them. And the result is a beautiful new book, self-published and striking, called The Paisley Tunnel, A Journey Across America. It is a portrait of 1970 America, with the story of Mark's adventure providing the narrative. This month, selected photographs from Mark's trip are hanging in the Little Theater Cafe's art gallery. Coming up in 2 weeks, I'll be hosting a panel discussion at the Little Theater about Mark's work, how America's changed, the value of seeing the world, photography, music, the protest movement, and more. And we're going to punctuate that evening with a screening of one of the best films of 1970, Five Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson. So a lot to get to. But first, let me welcome my guest and my good friend, Mark Brady, the author of The Paisley Tunnel. Nice to see you. How are you, Mark?
I'm great. Thank you.
Was that pretty good? How'd I do?
I'm not going to say anything because...
You just let me do the talking. No, you're here to do the talking. And he's brought Roger Bruce with him. And Roger is formerly of the Eastman Museum, was George Eastman House for years. And now he's on the Board of Trustees for Visual Studies Workshop. And Roger, it's great to see you. How are you?
Good to be here.
Well, Roger was just saying that what Mark did with this book is... something that I don't know if many people could do in terms of the quality, because the images are really, really striking. But, Roger, a lot of people can relate to having negatives that told these journeys, these stories, these coming-of-age stories that are probably sitting in a box somewhere.
Yes, I'd like to say that it's exemplary, but not... It is excellent, but it's exemplary for another reason, and that is that who doesn't have a shoebox full of old negatives? And Mark sets an example, possibly a high mark, but... I didn't intend that, but for the information that inheres and these old boxes and files with family negatives on them, it's amazing the stories that will unravel if you scan them and take some time to make them good.
When did you? I mean, Mark, you held on to these for about 40 years, but when did you really get serious again? What was it that made you think about these images?
I knew I was always going to do a book. But what made me realize I could easily do it was the coming of age of digital photography. So a friend of mine, Bob Doyle, and also Philip Lang, they showed me the photographs they had made with digital cameras. And I didn't realize how far digital photography had come. And then they told me I could do an online book also.
Yeah, that Mark, as Mark said, and I've known Mark because Mark's a photojournalist at 13 WHAM TV, so I've known Mark for years, and when you first mentioned this, it was like, well, I'm not going to publish a book to change my life. I don't want to spend years looking for an agent or a publishing house. I can do this on my own. That's why if you Google the Paisley Tunnel and blurb, you'll find the book, and the neat thing is this hour, if you happen to be listening online or somewhere, you can actually do kind of a preview of the book and see the images as we go.
Yeah, blurb.com is blurb. Is the website that I went to, and if you search the Paisley Tunnel, you'll be able to preview the whole book.
So you thought you could do it this way, and here it is. The book is out now. The images are hanging in the Little Theater's art gallery.
Right.
I hope everyone either comes out Sunday, because you technically have an opening on Sunday. Even though the images are up now, you've got an opening on Sunday at the Little Theater?
The images went up Saturday. The opening is Sunday from 2:30 to 4:30.
All right.
At the Little Theater
Sunday
Cafe.
Or Saturday?
Sunday.
Yes, that's right.
Did I say Saturday?
I think you did. Sunday, 2:30 to 4:30 is an opening reception for the images and the story. And then I hope our listeners will come visit and come out to the Little Theater at 6 p.m. Wednesday, March 16th. Now, I'll be there. Mark, Roger will be there. John Kovach from the University of Rochester's Institute of Popular Music is going to be there. And we're going to talk about the way the music of the time and the culture of the time dovetailed, and of course Mark is a musician as well, and so music is a big part of Mark's life. In fact, you know, Val, we should kick off with a little music here. I wonder if Mark, on that trip across America, was listening to this song, which had come out just weeks before and is quoted in Mark's book. This is James Taylor, Sweet Baby James.
With 10 miles behind me and 10,000 more to go, there's a song that they sing when they take to the highway.
So was this on the list when you were listening?
That is giving me chills.
Man.
That is giving me chills.
Did you listen that summer? Was this on there?
Absolutely. In fact, I can recall walking down into Ray's parents' basement. He was, and he has on James Taylor, and that was the first time I heard, and I went, wow, who is that? Because, it was like, that's the voice.
Yeah. And I've heard, by the way, he's never sang a note out of tune. Ever in his whole life. And that might be apocryphal, but if there's anybody who could do that, it might be James Taylor.
And at the time, we had AM radio, not FM. So oftentimes, we didn't get a great signal if you were out in the West, especially. But Taylor came on a lot.
Well, what I want to do is I want to listen to what John Kovach said about leading up to 1970, and then we're going to launch into Mark's journey here. Because remember, this was a time Mark's coming off going to Woodstock, with, I think, the whole rest of the country, either went or says they went now. And then the question is, what was the cultural impact? And so what I want to do is listen to John Kovach, who's going to be on our panel on Wednesday, March 16th. He is the director of the Institute for Popular Music, and he gave a sense for the impact of Woodstock and then Altamont, and then the way kind of the hippie aesthetic and different things were impacted. So this is a brief snippet of John Kovach talking about life 1960 into 1970. Not there. Well, we'll get to it later this hour. All right. But Mark, let me ask you then. Did Woodstock change you?
Yeah, I think anybody who went to an event like that has got to be changed. It's enlightening. Because I can recall that when we were driving up, we would see license plate after license plate from out of state, and then people are throwing us the peace sign, going up to Woodstock and offering us rather some comestibles, which we never took.
You never took?
and arriving at Woodstock and realizing we can't even get to the site. And so we pull over in a church. It was just, it was an amazing experience to realize that there was the tribe. The tribe was there. And they're just great vibes.
And so the interesting thing is Kovach kind of contrasts that to Altamont. So you had Woodstock, these great vibes, and then a lot of us have sort of forgotten, I think, what happened in December, which was, I think it was the Rolling Stones, maybe the Dead. Uh-huh. They were out in looking to have a free venue on the West Coast, right? And what was it, Altamont? Was it Racetrack or something like that?
Yeah, with the Hell's Angels supervising security.
The biggest mistake they could have made.
Supervising security, and someone got murdered in the crowd.
There was a fight, and there was a fellow apparently stepped on the motorcycles.
Yep.
And he was knifed.
He was knifed.
In fact, there's a documentary made called Sympathy for the Devil, and that's the Maisel brothers or Maisel brothers. And it documents the whole thing.
And so John Kovach points out that for all of the good vibes that were coming off of Woodstock, then that happens and that kind of dampened it a bit. And there was a kind of a little bit of a reckoning with real hippie culture versus, is it a hippie aesthetic? Is it authentic? What do people want? What is the music at the time going to say? So Mark and Ray decided you're going to tour the country in the summer of 1970, and I'm wondering then, why do it then? You and Ray are your best of friends, but why do it then after everything that was going on in the country?
He was graduating. The timing was perfect. We had decided, in the fall, a lot of people were talking about it. It was time to go. It was time to get away from the front porch, get away from the hometown.
From your parents?
From our parents. Exactly.
Honestly, I'm wondering, because I've heard people say, your generation wanted to show your parents that you could be something different.
That's interesting, because I think it's almost like when we got back, I had a sense that my father said all he wanted to make sure that we didn't get hurt. That was his biggest concern. And my sense was, from my mom, jealousy.
Jealousy. So you set out in the summer from where, by the way? Where were you traveling from?
We were on the north shore of Long Island, a small little square town in Nassau County. And we took off, went south first because I had a college friend who lived in Atlanta named Ross Capstein. And so we headed south to Atlanta.
And you were driving what?
A VW microbus, which was Ray had purchased.
It was a big tin can on wheels.
Yes. Right? He had purchased it about 2-3 months before and was using it as his travel vehicle. And before we even left, it blew up.
Now, did you have a plan for what was going to happen after it died? Because you knew at some point it was going to die.
We knew again. Yeah, we had a rebuilt engine put in it, but we knew as soon as we barely got off Long Island, and we're the mountains of Long Island, as I say in the book. We were going 30 miles an hour,
just
at hills, so
jangling along.
Yeah. So we took care of it as best we could, and. Cedar City, Utah is when it finally met its ultimate demise.
And the reason I think this is another callback to me of how America has changed in a way is that
yes.
You knew heading out that thing wasn't probably going to last the whole summer, but I guess you decided if that happens, you do what? You hitchhike, right?
We were just confident and relaxed and secure in ourselves, with each other, that no matter what happened, we would get through it. And there was a different time. It was a different time in the country. You could hitchhike. When it did happen, we shipped a whole bunch of stuff back to Long Island. We put what we needed in two knapsacks, and stuck out our thumbs and got rides.
Well, and here's something that made me think of Mark's journey. Listen to what the comedian Sebastian Maniscalco said about how America's changed from that time to now when it comes to the way we react to someone just showing up at our door. Because as we're going to find out as we go throughout the hour, Mark and Ray, we're relying occasionally on strangers, sometimes on two different Mormons who found you, things like that. And you could do that. The question is, Could you do that today? Do we welcome strangers today? This is Sebastian Maniscalco talking about people dropping in.
20 years ago, your doorbell rang. That was a happy moment in your house. It's called company. You'd be sitting there on a Thursday night watching TV. Your doorbell rang, the whole family shot off the couch. Oh my God! Put the lights on, somebody's here! We got people! The whole family went to the door. The kids were in socks, they slid up to the door. Nobody looked to see who it was. Now your doorbell rings. Like your own mother's crawling across the kitchen floor. Get down the army crawl. Army crawl, get in the closet.
It's a different time. And throughout the book, The Paisley Tunnel, you're going to see images of people, some who Mark knew before they left and many who they didn't. So you start by going to Atlanta because you at least knew you'd have a couch to be on or a floor to be on, right?
Right. And Ross was a great guy. He was from Jersey, but he brought a little Jersey down to Atlanta. But we were in the South, and it was... you had Southern comforts.
Have you been to the South before Atlanta?
Never been.
What did you think?
We wasn't shocked. We were hot. But apart from that, there was a Southern charm. And it was much more relaxed than the East. We were getting the Volkswagen oiled up. And there was this kind of, there wasn't a rush to oil it. It was 2 or 3 days. And we sort of got used to that.
And then you essentially headed west.
Yeah, we headed from Atlanta. We went up to the Smoky Mountains, across Tennessee, and then from Tennessee to Arkansas, and Arkansas into Texas.
And West Texas, you didn't love.
West Texas,
hauntingly
yeah.
beautiful. I mean, there are images of this book. Page 46 is one of my favorite images. It's just the silhouette of a small structure against the Texas sky and the flattest landscape you could see. And
that's West Texas.
So you and Ray are on this journey.
Yeah, at the same time in Texas, I saw probably one of the most stunning sunsets I'll ever see. Pitch pitch black on one side of the car and this deep purple on the other side of the car. And we're in the, you know, we're in the flatlands of Texas. I mean, Roger's from the South, so he can talk about the heat.
Where's home for
like
you
that.
Originally, Roger?
Well, the Carolinas. I grew up in North Carolina. And,
you laugh at Northerners in summer heat?
Well, there has been climate change that has moderated the difference entirely.
But, yeah.
And we're not in the South. I remember you referred to the fan, the attic fan, as big as a Volkswagen bug. That is so true. I grew up with one of those.
Right.
At night. No air conditioning. Air conditioning was not the assumption.
No air conditioning, yeah. We would stay with friends in Texas, and they literally, it is the size of a Volkswagen, an attic fan that sat flat on the floor. And that's, and they, it started, sounded like a Volkswagen in the house. And then, but it cooled off all the, cooled off the house and created this wind in the house.
I got to say, there are many images in your book that just look hot, from the cover image to the image of another VW bus. As you're riding along, you get another VW. I love this scene in West Texas. Another couple in a different VW bus riding along, and you got a picture of it here. And Mark writes, in the spirit of Woodstock, they waved us over, and they offered us some smoky comestibles. The heat and humidity were making us loopy enough, so we wouldn't have made it out of Texas if we had imbibed. In fact, you did so little in the way of drugs on this trip that I was surprised.
Right. We, yeah.
You really didn't.
Everybody expects, you know, they expected us, you know, they thought we, you know, I show the book, they think we did nothing.
You're high on every page.
We're high on every page.
But you're not.
No. We did a little bit of something in New Mexico, and that was it.
And that was it.
Yeah. We couldn't. It was too hot. We were concerned about traveling in the bus, and we had other things to do. Yeah.
And so you make your way to one of my favorite interludes in the book is White Sands. And
yeah, that's also one of mine.
I want to kind of just read a paragraph here because it gets to a point as Mark describes this journey across the country. Occasionally, you'd have these places you wanted to see, and a few times here and there, you were disappointed. You couldn't find something. You know, you made it down to the Rio Grande River Gorge looking for the famous Easy Rider Hot Springs. You called it a wild goose chase.
It was.
But here was this really, I thought, beautiful moment in White Sands, and I want to read what Mark writes here.
Roger likes this segment too because it kind of, you know, it kind of brings to fore what the unexpected can do for you.
Yeah, and so Mark writes, the setting of the sun, slanted shadows flowing up the dunes, gradually drifting and shifting until they start to envelop me, ambling through the sands to a new spot, deep shadows, isolated specks of vegetation, the light moving and shimmering on the crystal sands, then looking back to find Ray, and then coming up over a small dune to where I thought he could be, and off in the distance, a silhouetted figure, his back to me, walking up the dunes, toward the setting sun beyond me and into the shadows. And what you find next is a series of images that look, frankly, fake. It is so beautiful. And then you see that image of Ray sitting on top of this dune in silhouette.
Yeah.
And Roger Bruce, I go throughout Mark's book and I think he shoots natural landscape as beautifully as just about anybody I've seen, but he also shoots human beings so genuinely, so authentically. There aren't posed shots, you know, corny stuff. It's real human life everywhere they went, whether it was Ray or other people. And I just appreciate that as an amateur looking on.
He does know when to point and when to shoot. And sure, there are some happy accidents here, but Mark is the artist to put them together. And that narrative is pretty darn good, too.
It was good.
Very poignant.
Yeah. But we're also giving Mark a ton of credit. I mean, we don't know what you edited out. I mean, how many images did you start with?
1,300 negatives. There's 40 plus contact sheets. So there's it's funny because there's 175 photographs in the book in total, roughly. And in the show, there's going to be 23.
Talking to Mark Brady, a photojournalist who, at the age of 26 in the summer of 1970, took a trip across the country and, thankfully for us, took his camera with him, along with his best friend Ray, and captured the story of a journey across America. In some ways, a similar America, in some ways, very different. And his new book is called The Paisley Tunnel, A Journey Across America. It's self-published. Selections of Mark's work and photography are on display now and for the month of March at the Little Theater's Art Gallery in their cafe. And there's a couple of events coming up. 2:30 to 4:30 this coming Sunday at the Little Cafe for an opening reception. And then the big event on Wednesday, March 16th at 6 p.m. at the Little Theater. And I hope you'll be there. I'll be there moderating a panel with Mark, Roger Bruce, and John Kovach from the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, talking about music and culture at the time. We're going to talk about 1970 Versus today, and we're going to punctuate it with the film Five Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson, one of the underrated American films. And a little later this hour, you're going to hear Jack Garner describe it, and I love the way he describes the film. So we're working our way through the book, and here's another spot I just kind of want to read from, because you encountered some adversity here and there on the way, and there's a lesson that I think is bigger than a single argument and bigger than a single moment here. You ended up sort of, I think, leaving White Sands exhausted, and you got into the, you said, your only screaming argument of this road trip. Now imagine 3,000 miles or whatever it was, and only one big screaming argument. And, here's what you wrote about that. It was one of those times that we both physically, emotionally, and psychically burned out. If one of us had been having a bad day, the other usually would pick up on it, simply asking, "Are you doing all right?" And that always made it a bit better. That was the thing. We always managed to take care of each other. And sometimes if we couldn't, others did that for us, whether they knew it or not. We both knew, but would come to realize intimately, that the world is a beautiful place if you don't mind a touch of hell from time to time. That was just the way we were, and it's just the way it was. So I thought, that's a great moment, because you're talking about one argument, but you're talking about life.
Yeah.
And sometimes we tend to overblow an argument. And I've known road trips and summer adventures that ended on one argument. People walked away and went separate ways, and it's a good thing you did not do that.
I don't think we could have, because But Randy, yeah, it was like, you're so irritated at some point, and that was one of those points. And it's like, it's interesting because Roger and I were talking about the golden hour, and we had not realized that we had arrived at White Sands at the golden hour.
Which is, what's the golden hour, by the way?
Oh, it's when the light is raking across the landscape. You can see details. The shadows bring out the third dimension. It really is generally lovely.
Flatter light, I guess.
Flat light doesn't hurt, but it's best to have the softer but direct light of the sun that is hitting across textures, and it brings out the sand and the dune shapes and the figure against the horizon.
Well. As we work our way into New Mexico, the 4th of July, you tell the story, and we see a picture of a man with his arms folded leaning on your vehicle. And you say that you've since forgotten that man's name, but he was hanging out, was drawn to us, and we connected in a moment that was authentic and honest, and he seemed older than his years. He told us he felt at a dead end, and his envy of us was palpable. I felt terrible that someone so close to my age could feel so trapped. We talked only briefly, and I tried to give him some encouragement, but felt any words I could say were trivial. He knew I was someone who could so easily leave right then and there. In hindsight, I probably took that freedom for granted. We said our goodbyes, shook hands, and I wished him luck, but ultimately, I still felt empty for him as we headed back on the road north of Santa Fe, and it has to this day left a lasting impression. Why did that leave such an impression on you, Mark?
We connected. There was a chemistry right there. You know, sometimes you connect with people, sometimes you don't. And I just had an empathy for this kid. And it's like I said, I mean, I could be gone in a second. I had freedom. And I just felt terrible that here's a kid in a small town, feels he can't leave. He doesn't know what he wants to do. He doesn't have the money. Or the background or the education or whatever, I don't know. I didn't know a lot about him, but I knew that I could leave, he couldn't. Yeah. And we would see that across the country.
You had the empathy to see his longing for the road and knew that he didn't have the options, likely, that you did.
Perfectly said, yeah. That's it, yeah.
I think you wrote that.
Well, and I have to say as well, I mean, Mark, you guys weren't, you and Ray weren't two people with all that much money in your jeans, you know? So you're looking at somebody with empathy, but, you know, you're not high rolling.
No. No, we have
the... You just felt the freedom that he didn't feel.
Yeah, there are times when you really feel your own privilege if you're a writer or a photographer.
And that is, that's what it, and Roger says it perfectly. It's, it, you know, we had that privilege. We had the ability to, and we had people that we could call. I could call and get money wired to me, you know, because I had parents or I had friends even that could back us up. And so we never felt insecure about where we were.
Well, eventually, that old microbus was going to die. I mean, we're going to have to start relying on strangers. So, but before we get to our only break of the hour, Mark, can you tell us a little bit about the A-Frame, the Llama Foundation, the people you met there? Because, again, some of the people you met on this trip you knew you were going to find, and some you did not. And I love this story here.
I found this is the – there's a shot of an A-Frame. So we go up a dirt road to look for the great commune in the sky, and we see a teepee across some barbed wire. And we get out of the microbus, and a fella comes walking out of the teepee toward us, and he goes, howdy, howdy. And we go, howdy, howdy.
Just right back.
right back. And it turns out to be this guy, Satya. He's from Newark. He's spent the whole winter with his girlfriend in that teepee, and he was building an A-frame for the next winter. And we told him why we were up there, and he said, well, let's take a trip up the dirt road. There's the Llama Foundation. And years later, I finally was able to contact Satya again. As it turned out, the Llama Foundation was fantastic, and that was insightful, life-changing. Real people doing a real thing. Commune living.
And it was interesting to me because you write about it. The photographs, again, are beautiful, and I'm trying not to overstate it, but really the images are really remarkable. And what you write about was, I thought, really interesting. You wrote with such admiration for the way they were living and the way they were caring for each other, building structures for each other, you know, providing the meals, rotating who's cooking. But then you sort of decide, yeah, that's not for us. You know, sometimes, you know, you were very honest about it. You had this great admiration for it, but you couldn't do it for longer, any much more, I think.
Right. That was not going to be our lifestyle. And Bray and I knew that, you know, we had to see it. You had to see it to know that. And I was able to contact Satya eventually. Find his last name through the Llama Foundation, which does still exist. It's a retreat now. But he turned out to be moving to L.A. and became Dennis Hopper's personal assistant. Because Hopper comes to Taos and they want to shoot they're shooting the film Easy Rider, and Satya becomes their tour guide and takes them down to the Hop Springs and ends up befriending Dennis Hopper and moving to L.A. and becomes his personal assistant.
Really amazing stories that Mark discovered on the way in 1970. Yeah. It's his story, but in many ways it's the story of America at that time. And it's a story of America that is different in some ways and the same in some ways. Let's get a short break, and we're going to come back with Mark and Roger. We're going to talk more about his book, his photographs, the America that he discovered then. And I want to tell you about the event that's coming up on Wednesday the 16th. So when we come back, we'll hear from Jack Garner as well. So short break and much more straight ahead. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, first hour, all about hoaxes. Why do we believe certain things that are not true? Whether it's visual hoaxes or even hoax quotations. Thomas Jefferson said this, and Abraham Lincoln said that, and we spread it around the internet. We'll examine that first hour. Then second hour, which of the Super Bowl ads do you still remember? The changing face of advertising in America. Talk with you Wednesday.
Astronaut Scott Kelly is about to return from a year aboard the International Space Station.
I think the hardest part is being isolated, in a physical sense from people on the ground that are important to you.
His year in space and Super Tuesday reports from across the country later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A listener named Joel writes to the program and says, wants to know what Mark and Ray were reading on the trip and what maps or guidebooks did they use? Let's work backwards. Maps and guidebooks. What did you use? Do you remember?
Yeah, we got a map, a map of the United States, and opened it up and just followed the routes. We didn't have Google. Yes.
You didn't have an iPhone app for
didn't
that.
Didn't have an iPhone app for that.
How many times do you think you got lost? Countless? Too many to know? Or were you pretty good?
We would, you know what? We got lost a couple of times. The Grand Canyon is one specific time that was very bad. And we would get pointed in the wrong direction. But it was almost a treat to get lost because we could you know, it's an open highway out west, and so it's very difficult to get lost.
Roger, do you hear that? Mark says a treat to get lost. I think kids growing up today won't even know what it is like to be lost because of generally of GPS.
Yes, it's taken me a long time to rediscover the thrill of being lost or the pleasure of it, but retirement has afforded that.
You're hearing Roger Bruce, who is formerly of the George Eastman House, and he's going to join our panel in a couple of weeks. He's here with photojournalist Mark Brady, who is the author of the book The Paisley Tunnel, A Journey Across America, the story of his trip in 1970 with his best friend, and the photographs that tell the story, the stunning photographs across the country. Joel also wanted to know, what were you reading? And a lot of what you wrote, or at least some, shows up in some of the notes in your book here and there. A lot of Kerouac. What else were you reading?
I wasn't reading a lot. Ray probably read some stuff, and I really forget. I think we're just too, I think we're almost too busy in traveling. Traveling can be it's an effort. And it's not sometimes it's not so pleasurable, but that part of the trip, I can say honestly, I forget what
all the things you might have been reading.
Yeah, all the things we might have been reading. Kerouac is something that I probably came to, maybe even after the trip.
Okay, because he shows up here and there in your notes in the book, maybe to refer back to, or at least make some sense of some of what
bingo.
You saw on the road.
Yes,
I love this caption on page 114. You're out at. Oh, boy, you're Boulder, Colorado.
We were just outside of
Lake Isabel.
Yes, Isabel National Forest.
And there is this shot, this sweeping vista of some snow-covered mountains and some trees and some pine barren, it looks like. And the caption says, a friend jokingly said, who knows, there's probably a 7-Eleven there now. I don't want to know. Now I don't want to know what's there now. You know, part of me is wondering, what does America look like that's different?
You know,
I don't want to know if there's a 7-Eleven.
I'm going to attribute that quote to someone we both know. His name is Jeff Sprague.
Oh, Jeff Sprague. Well, Jeff is very wise to wonder that. Jeff's also a colleague from 13WAM TV. So Mark makes his way then, past Zion National Park, and then the VW bus died. And thankfully for you, you found a cheerful young Mormon who was willing to help you. I love this story. You said that back from a mission, and he was probably just looking to do a good deed, and he found you guys.
Yeah, we pulled into we were on our way to Zion when the bus breaks down. We have it towed into Cedar City. We don't, you know, there's a strip there. We go up and we think we want to hitch up to Zion and we can't because we have to stand on top of the highway and no one's going to stop. There's no one around. We walk back down the strip. We pull into a gas station. We talk to this kid very briefly. He says, you want to go up to Zion? Well, if you want to wait an hour, I'll pick up my girlfriend and I'll drive you up there without a qualm about it.
Yeah, who are these guys? Are you threatening? Do we treat strangers differently now than we did then, Mark? I mean, it feels obvious.
I feel
like the answer has to be yes, but you lived it. You experienced it. So what do you think?
I mean, I can recall numerous times driving on highways, 20 years ago even, and I'll see a hitcher and I hesitate.
And that was you for years.
And that was me, and I feel guilty about it. When I was coming back up to Rochester, I was on the getting onto the thruway from one of the exits, and there was a guy hitching, and I picked him up. But I questioned myself. I said, "What should you be doing this?" Turned out everything was fine. But, you know, people can make the trip that we made. They just have to do it differently. You know, and so I would even be hesitant to pick up a hitcher.
Today, yeah.
There were a lot of people hitching at that time also.
Roger, did you hitch?
I did, and it was the sense, you're right, the sense was that you could just sort of fall back into the arms of the highway, and that good people would give you a spot in the back seat.
Perfect, yeah.
But that doesn't exist. It's not in the mind. It's not available in our mental Rolodex.
And this is why, you know, when Mark kind of brought the book forward, I think Mark has said admirably so, At first, he was paralyzed trying to over-intellectualize it. And right. And I respect that because he has his meaning. But I find everybody I know who's picked up the book has taken their own sort of meanings. And one of the things I take is looking at what has changed and what hasn't. And I don't think people can get lost anymore the same way. I don't think people view strangers the same way. I don't think doors are open the same way. You know, you end up out there in California. You got these beautiful shots at Berkeley. Set the scene in Berkeley, by the way, because that was a lot of fun to kind of...
The scene itself on the campus?
Yeah.
It was a circus, a little bit of a circus atmosphere.
And just what we read about.
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff going on. There was, you know, the gypsy dancer, and there's a girl with a guitar, and there's a older gentleman doing puppetry, and there's someone lecturing, doing a political stump lecture with a bunch of people under trees. And one of my coworkers, this fellow John Doss, went to Berkeley, and he looked at those pictures. And, you know, the same. He knew the quad. I forget now what building he mentions it, but he said the same stuff. It's still going on. There's still those kinds of things. You know, there's a lot of activity in that. But there was a great energy. It was very relaxed, and it wasn't. There was not any political stuff as much nearly as was before, and it was at the time also. Because I realized when I was watching Eye on the Prize or the Black Panthers, they were talking there about in 1970 how the Black Panthers are being harassed in Oakland. But we were completely unaware of that kind of stuff.
Here is an email from Andrew. Just says... great stuff this hour. Can't wait to check out the gallery. And you can tell Mark that I hitchhiked too many times. Never felt scared in the back seat of a car or the front seat.
Yeah. Right.
Did you ever feel scared?
No, we never did. Never did, really. No, not a bit. Never waited more than 15 minutes. We're picked up by... It was like a microcosm of everybody in America. You know, anybody from drugged up Volkswagen mechanics to teachers to Mormons to fellow hippies.
And here's a picture on page 165 of a nice looking man with long hair playing the guitar. And for people who pick up the book, the first thing if they're just kind of flipping through, they'll say that face looks familiar. Well, here was a guy who was. You know, he's in L.A. trying to make his way, just like a lot of people were. And he did. His name is Michael McKean.
Michael McKean.
You're hanging out with Michael McKean. Now, he turns out, it was 6 years later that he ends up on Laverne and Shirley, Squiggy and Lenny. I don't know if he was Squiggy or Lenny.
He was Lenny.
He was Lenny.
I think.
I think he was Lenny.
I'm getting the thumbs up from the people.
There you go. Thank you. And, of course, he ends up on Spinal Tap, Saturday Night Live, many others, the Christopher Guest films.
Right. He's the guy that wants to turn the amp up to 11.
To 11. Yes. This one goes to 11. But, you know, you just started hanging out. How did you end up hanging out with Michael McKean?
Well, Ray had graduated 3 years after I had from North Shore High School on Long Island. And so Ray and Michael went to, would have graduated from the same class. So Michael is from the same area as Long Island Ray and I were from. So we knew we could stay there. He was living in a studio apartment, an alleyway apartment. He was jobless with his girlfriend. But he was the best host in the world. He took us around to some of the canyons. We played music with him, and we stayed with him for 3 or 4 days. And who knew?
who knew where he was going? Then the next page, they're heading off again, hitchhiking again, and there's a picture of Ray holding a camera as a police officer writes a ticket. And the caption says, "Ticketed for hitching on the freeway. We never paid it."
No.
You have an unpaid hitching ticket up in the West Coast.
I could get arrested.
Do you know
what
that's worth? You know what I mean now? With inflation. And speaking of hitching, Stephen Brighton is listening. He wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, you guys. I'm enjoying the conversation.
And thanks.
Remember hitchhiking in Europe when I was younger in the 70s. But 2 weeks ago, I did a wonderful road trip down Highway 61 in Mississippi to New Orleans.
Runs right by my baby's door.
That's now the Dylan. Blues Highway, okay? And there were hitchhikers from Europe checking out the blues sites, you know, all the way down, and there's hundreds of them. And pretty interesting thing to see. But like I say, most of the hitchhikers are from Europe, not from here.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for the phone call. And you just dropped a Bob Dylan line, didn't you?
Yeah,
you were listening
to some
Bob Dylan at the time, weren't you? I suspect you were. Another listener just writes in and wants to know, let's see here, any other parks that you want to mention that you visited? And because I can't cover his entire book, by the way. We're kind of picking out highlights from the Paisley Tunnel, which if you're just joining us in the summer of 1970, Mark, a photojournalist, longtime 13 Wham photojournalist. He was 26, traveled across the country, took these images, and now they are in a book, Stunning Black and White Images of America. And another listener says, what other parks, any reservations, any indigenous people that you encountered?
Well, probably the kids in the gas station. I can't really say if they were Mexican-American or Indian, indigenous.
Then it's Santa Fe, if I remember. Where was that?
And the gas station was somewhere in New Mexico, probably on our way up to Taos. Well, I'm sorry, what was the...
Any other parks or things?
We went to Arches, we went to Lake... There were so many parks we could have gone to that we missed. But we went to Arches, we were at Lake Powell. I'm trying to think now, God. We were at Zion for a day. I mean, any of these parks that you go to, you could spend a week, you could spend a month in.
The Great Smoky Mountains.
There's Golden Gate Park and
Thank
Arboretum.
You. Right.
So there's Golden Gate Park there. I'm seeing Big Sur, just the images from Big Sur. So yeah, there's
Big
a lot.
Sir. Yeah. Big Sur, yeah.
There's a lot that I can't fully encapsulate. So before I close the hour and what's coming up later this month, because I want to remind you can see some of Mark's images, a couple dozen, I think, now at the Little Theater. You chose a couple dozen, which...
Yes.
Narrowing it down from 1,300 to a book and then a book to a couple dozen was probably not very easy, but he's done that. And so you can see some of the images at the Little Theater Cafe's art gallery this month. They're on display. And I'm going to tell you about an event in a moment, but let me just ask Roger Bruce just for a little bit more of a view into the medium of photography, because Mark came back to these images because he thought, I can now take them, and using technology, I can at least self-create a book, I can use these, etc. But a lot of people are now shooting digital images. What's the quality difference between what Mark was doing in 1970 and today, Roger?
Actually, it's really something of a challenge to find that negatives that are that old and obtain prints of the quality that we have here. And digital photography is part of the answer. The ability to scan old negatives and use digital techniques that are analogs to darkroom dodging and burning and what have you have made all the difference. When you see the actual prints in the exhibit, you might think that these were made with a large view camera. I mean, the quality is really extraordinary. And Bob Dole's printing, too. But your ability to work with those negatives, scratchy, dusty, they were. I saw the dust and the scratches. You even put one in the book. There's a big, nasty photo
That's
in there
right.
still. There.
Yeah.
Digital, now having said that, this is a controversial statement, but I believe that the quality that exists now in digital photography exceeds anything available to a 35-millimeter film shooter in the day. The technology is fantastic.
Yes, Mark?
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. I look at Roger posts stuff on Facebook. He has a camera, a digital camera now that puts out absolutely stunning images. Let me do one thing before we leave,
Well, we're not leaving yet. You got like 10 minutes. Go ahead.
Roger mentioned Rob.
I'm not kicking you out. I'm enjoying this conversation. But go ahead.
But Roger mentioned Bob Doyle, who's a great friend, and he was a great help. I give him a credit in the book, but he was a great help with printing. But I also like to thank yourself and Nathan Lyons at the Visual Studies Workshop. And there's a group of us that get together for coffee. I call it the Old Geezer Smart Women group. On Saturdays, we go to Press Coffee, and some of the people there I wasn't able to thank in the book. There's a bunch of people I do thank in the book. So this Steve Piper and Julie Gelfand, who were really helpful when the book came out and very complimentary. And then there's Carl Scherenza, who was very kind and generous, and I watched him with Nathan sit at the coffee table and go through the book page by page by page, and Nathan was looking over his shoulder saying, get to California, get to California.
Well,
Carl was really great and offered to exchange books. So, and he gave me a two. He gave me two of his. I got, and he only got one of mine. It's the only one I have.
It's a good trade. Good trade. Good job, Mark. So Mark's book is The Paisley Tunnel, 1970, A Journey Across America. And so we figured what we would do on Wednesday night, March 16th at 6 p.m., is invite the public, come on out to the Little Theater, and we're going to have a little panel discussion. Mark's going to be there. Roger's going to be there. I will be there moderating. We're going to talk about Mark's journey. We're going to talk about what America was like then. We're going to talk about the medium of photography. We're going to talk about the music. We're going to talk about the culture. So John Kovach from the University of Rochester's Institute for Popular Music will be there. And Jack Garner can't be there, but Jack wanted to weigh in on his thoughts because we're going to punctuate the night with a film from 1970 at the Little Theater. You're going to get a chance to see Five Easy Pieces, which is, let me just read real briefly here what Roger Ebert says. He says it's one of the great American films, and Jack Nicholson as Bobby is one of the most unforgettable characters in American movies, period. Here's Jack Garner telling us what he thinks about Five Easy Pieces and Jack Nicholson in it.
Fabulous. Now, I would put it in my top three of Jack Nicholson films ever. I think it's a great, great movie. It's a really very poignant story of a man trying to come to grips with who he is and what his relationship should be with his family. The title comes from the fact that he could have been a great pianist, but he just gave it up. And he went and he worked in the oil fields, which is where you find him at the beginning of the film. And he could have been a really fine piano player, and his family, his sister who plays, and his father, you know, regret that he made that decision. But the father is probably near death, and he's suffering with kind of an Alzheimer's thing, and the son tries to relate to him in some way, and there's a very touching scene without any conversation where they are still trying to relate to each other, and then there's the very famous funny scene when he tries to order toast in a restaurant, but I'll let people discover that for themselves. He's very strong in it. He really conveys a character that you believe in and that you are really fascinated by, and you're sort of hopeful for him that he can maybe work out some of these problems. It's also made by a very fine director who had made good films at that time, but then sort of faded away, which is Bob Rafelson, a really good director, and did several good films with Jack Nicholson. And then, of course, you know, they worked up to the really, you know, Chinatown would be another great one, of course, and a couple others. But this was that early seed period, and it came up with a great plant, if I may stretch that metaphor. It's really good. And Karen Black is great in it, an actress who, you know, had her moment, and this was her moment, quite frankly. And so I really highly recommend Five Easy Pieces. I'm excited that there's an attempt to get back on a big screen. No, that's a good choice. It's technically not a road picture, although it has a little bit of aspect to that. And this was a great film, and it does show there are a lot of movies that I see from the 70s, and I remember talking to some of the filmmakers years later. And for example, I talked to Dustin Hoffman once, and we were talking about The Graduate from this same period. And he says, you know, they couldn't even get The Graduate made today. And I talked to the guy who made Midnight Cowboy, and he says, nobody would make Midnight Cowboy today. Because they're just a different generation, and they're different subjects, and they're tougher, and they're not as easy to understand sometimes. I mean, you're not being spoon-fed, but they're great films. And I love Five Easy Pieces.
So you got a chance to see it. Five Easy Pieces, which will follow the panel discussion. So panel discussion first, 6 p.m., Wednesday, March 16th. I'll be there. And then the film. And if you want to hang around afterwards, we'll chat. We'll have a cup of coffee or a drink in the little cafe, which is a great place. Take a look at a little bit more Mark's photography. Maybe trade hitchhiking stories. Like my father said, Ev, we hitchhiked all the time. Jamestown to Miami, Ohio, where he went to school. He said that was our mode of transportation. And I said, how was it? He said, it was great. He said, we got picked up by a woman with no nose. And she was the nicest person you ever met. He said, you know, you met characters, but it felt safe. And it's a different America now. So let me kind of close the hour with this here. Mark, you should be very proud, I think, of the book because it is beautiful. The work is beautiful. The images are haunting and stirring. And we've been talking about what's different and how you can't do that anymore. You can't do this, you can't do that. But I know you really believe that the human spirit is made to kind of break away from our boundaries. So you still tell people, especially your younger friends, okay, life's different, but go out and do it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's in our DNA. We, you know, humans want to see what's out there, what's beyond our borders. And when what's encouraging is when I've gone out and done stories, I think this generation and generations, that will be coming after me, they will go out. You know, people, my friends, and I talk to young people who are taking a trip to Asia, just going. You know, they're giving up their job that they have. They want to travel, or they have the security that they'll be coming back to the job. They'll take a leave of absence. But I absolutely believe you can do it now. You might not be able to hitch. It's a little darker, America, a little more dangerous in some level. But there's great people that you will meet out there. And it's still a safe world, and you can travel.
Amen. And as Mark mentioned, and as Roger pointed out, that moment with the man you met was about recognizing privilege. Even though you didn't have all the money in the world, you had the privilege and the freedom to travel. And something of travel will always be about privilege. But what I appreciate from the Paisley Tunnel is this wasn't, I'm going to go blow a bunch of money and go to a place and isolate myself. This was traveling to see the world and become a more well-rounded person. And I saw that in you and the way you took those photographs. Roger, some closing thoughts from you on the book. What do you think?
Yes, travel with a capital T. I mean, it exemplifies so much. The whole project exemplifies a sort of you can too. I mean, for the audience, for me, when I look at this and I immediately conjure, because I'm jealous, I mean, it's such a nice project, that take a trip, A to B, it's a story, it's a narrative, and you did it very well.
It reminds me to leave a little extra time when you travel, because you may meet someone you want to spend an afternoon with.
Yeah.
Go have dinner with. Don't feel like you have to over-schedule the trip. Let it come to you, and you're going to see in the Paisley Tunnel, 1970, A Journey Across America by Mark Brady, that work. Now, it's on Blurb, and it's expensive because that's what it is when you self-publish it. But if you don't pick it up on, well, you can certainly can, but if you don't do it that way, you can at least see some of the images online, and you can see them all month in the Little Theater's cafe and gallery there. And then we'll see you out on Wednesday, March 16th at 6 p.m. for our panel discussion and a lot of fun at the Little Theater. So I'll see you there. Roger, I'll see you there. Thank you for being here, sir. Great talking to you.
Good to be here.
Mark Brady, congratulations, sir. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much, man. You're the best.
Well, very good. I know. Val LeBanc is the engineer of this broadcast, and Megan Mack is the producer. Great work today. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Meg's here tomorrow, and I'm hosting a couple of hours the rest of the week, so we're kind of hodgepodging it, and we got a lot of great stuff to come. So nice talking to you on Member Supported Public Radio, and we'll talk with you on a Wednesday.